On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you live within a country mile of a cornfield, you've already heard the roar over ethanol. Across the Midwest and well beyond, a great corn-fed ethanol gold rush is on. Farmers and towns and states betting big on an ethanol boom as oil prices soar on Mideast instability. Investment bankers, venture capitalists Bill Gates, and old-fashioned oil companies pouring big money into new plants and technology. Congress fueling the whole parade with huge subsidies and tax incentives. You can now drive from Chicago to Kansas City with high-test ethanol pumps along the whole corridor. But will all this hot new moonshine fuel the country? Up next on Point, the ethanol boom and where it's taking homegrown American energy. We go first today right to corn country and the ethanol heartland. Joining me from Reynolds, Indiana, is Town Council President Charlie Van Voorst. His town, Reynolds, with a population of around 550, is about 85 miles north of Indianapolis. The town is working to live up to its new nickname, Biotown USA, with a goal of being 100% powered by biorenewable energy. Charlie Van Voorst, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And
welcome
with
Biotown.
Well, we're glad to be there. We want to hear about it. With us also from Indianapolis is Becky Skillman, Indiana's Lieutenant Governor and a big backer of the ethanol biofuel push. Becky Skillman, Lieutenant Governor, thank you for being with us.
Tom, great to be with you.
Charlie, first to you, if I may. 550 people in Reynolds, sort of halfway between Indianapolis and Chicago. What have you got going on there?
Great things, Tom. Back in June of 2005, the governor's office came to us and offered us a chance to be the first biotown in the world.
And this is Governor Mitch Daniels, Republican, Becky's partner there in Indianapolis, and they said,
correct.
Reynolds, how about it? What did they propose?
They asked us if we was interested in being the first biorenewable town in the world. And of course, we accepted. And since then, things have just been great, crazy. I mean, we're just so excited to be involved in this, and we'd just love to thank them for their support and their thinking that we could do that, and we appreciate that.
Now, I know that you've got a lot of attention for this, ABC and CBS and The Daily Show and The New York Times. Everybody's looking at Reynolds lately. Do you see this as part of the ethanol boom, Charlie? Do you feel the ethanol excitement around you there? You're deep in corn country. Can you feel it?
Yes, I can. At first, that wasn't part of what we were talking about. You know, when this first came to us, the whole idea was to make a small community self-sufficient by using biorenewable fuels to replace the electric natural gas and some transportation fuels.
And not just corn and ethanol, but everything from hog manure and, you know, right on down, biomass.
Yes, that's correct. Small towns have issues with their sewage management issues, and this is part of what could help our small community take care of those. It's going to help with our farm community, our livestock, our hog farmers, the possibility of expanding. And it's just a neat thing to be a part of this and be the showcase of the world and be able to write the book on how this is being done.
Becky Skillman, Lieutenant Governor, is it really happening? I see reports here, $10 million coming in to crank up a biofuel, bioenergy program for Reynolds. Is that all it takes for a town of 550?
Well, it's a little more complicated, but Biotown is our state and our local initiative, both partners to create this community powered solely on biorenewable resources. We do have a managing energy investor to step forward to accommodate this three-suite technology that will convert the animal waste, the municipal waste, to electricity. That was phase two of the project. Phase one, which was completed early, was to make Reynolds the highest per capita user in the country of flex fuel vehicles. That goal has been accomplished as well through some assistance from General Motors providing 20 of those cars, and then residents and rentals purchasing more flex fuel vehicles. So we certainly need to make that ethanol available to them as well and to other residents of the state of Indiana. So we've been very aggressive on that front, not only production facilities, but making it available to motorists.
Charlie Van Voorst, there was a little oops factor when the New York Times came to town. GM has sent you guys 20 cars, flex fuel, ethanol cars, two-year leases, but the nearest E85 pump, that is the sort of high-test ethanol, high-proportion ethanol pump, was many miles away. So you've got the cars. Do you have a pump to fill them up from?
Not right now, but we're working on it. We're getting very close to the grand opening of that, and we're hoping latter part of August we will have that open. So, yes, we did have a little setback there, but it's working out great now, and we're getting closer to that point, and we're looking forward to that. We're very excited about getting our vehicles running on E85 and supporting our farmers with local use of their corn and cleaning our environment up. So it is a big thing for the town of Reynolds to be able to do that.
Governor Mitch Daniels is quoted saying it's a little bit of a stunt putting the label on and going forward. On the other hand, the excitement you can feel around the Midwest is palpable. Do you really think it's going to happen, Charlie? Are you going to be free of imported oil dependence?
Not completely free, but I think this is going to be a big part of educating the world in a small way that we can do this, and we are going to ease part of that dependency on foreign oils, and it's a step forward, and hopefully everybody will follow and can see that it can be done in a small community, and hopefully it'll be showing all over the world that it can be done, and other little small communities will follow us and do the similar thing. And we just think it's a great, great opportunity for more communities than just ourselves. No.
Biotown, USA. Lieutenant Governor Skillman, what about for Indiana on a larger scale? You grow a lot of biomass there, a lot of corn, just for starters, that can already go straight into ethanol. How important economically do you envision this being for the state's future? How much excitement do you feel about it there?
Indiana is the fifth largest corn state. We're the fourth largest soybean state. And a short period of time, we've actually gone from nowhere to national leadership in the area of biofuels. In a little more than a year's time, we have 11 new ethanol production facilities and 3 new biodiesel production facilities that are in some stage of construction. In fact, today we celebrate the first gallon of biodiesel to be produced in our state, and the governor is celebrating within that community. Economically, all of these new production facilities will create almost 600 new jobs for Indiana residents. It also puts more than $15 million in local farmers' pockets, and the investment has totaled more than $1.3 billion in capital expenses.
And how important long-term? Your fourth or fifth biggest there in those grain productions. You may not be the Saudi Arabia of the ethanol future, but might you be the Kuwait or the Oman? I mean, is this really a big deal for Indiana's economy?
Our goal is to produce 1 billion gallons of biofuel annually, and with the new plants we have sited, we're very, very close to that goal, and yet we have more and more projects being discussed. Rural development has been one of my passions through the years, and we're certainly seeing that biofuel plants are rural development at its finest. Boosts farmers' profits, creates new jobs, and certainly helps raise awareness about biofuels and bioenergy to make it part of our state's natural culture.
Sounds like Indiana is ready to roll. Lieutenant Governor Becky Skillman in Indianapolis, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Charlie Van Voorst, Town Council President in Reynolds, Indiana, Biotown, USA. Charlie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate you letting us being on the air, so thank you so much.
Great to have you. With me now from Chicago, Alexi Barrio Nuevo, National Business Correspondent for the New York Times. Alexi, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can't miss this sort of noise barrage about ethanol and biofuel coming out of the Midwest these days. There's a poster child right there in Reynolds, Indiana. How do you describe the scale of this wave of investment and interest in ethanol, biofuel, the works?
Well, it truly is extraordinary, and it truly is a gold rush, or some might say, though it's perhaps an internet bubble waiting to happen all at the same time. I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, to give you some statistics, there are some 39 new ethanol plants that are expected to be completed just in the next 9 to 12 months, which will, you know, increase the ethanol current production from about 4.5 billion gallons by 30% more. And that's just the next 9 to 12 months. There are a number of other plants, dozens of other plants, that are in the sort of preliminary planning stages or have preliminary approvals. And in the state of, for instance, in the state of Iowa, there's a staggering 55 ethanol plants that are operating or have been proposed, which is remarkable. One Iowa State economist, university economist, said that if all those plants were actually built, that they would use virtually all of the corn grown in Iowa. So it's staggering, and the kind of investors that are interested in ethanol and getting interested in and sinking money into $70 to $100 million plants is, you know, covers the range from farmers that are getting involved in co-ops, which is an important sector, to you know, to venture capitalists and hedge funds and the like. As Bill Gates has even gotten gotten involved in an ethanol investment.
Alexei, there's a lot we want to learn from you. First of all, just some basics. I mean, ethanol currently primarily means corn. It means taking the kernels of corn, sort of grinding them up, making moonshine, and adding a little gasoline to it so people don't drink it, and you've got fuel.
Right. Well, that's one way of looking at it, right? That's sort of the fermentation process. That's sort of what it entails. There's sort of a it can be used in a sense. You can do it in a dry or wet mill, as they call it, Either one, you know, can produce the same fuel that's of the same quality to be used in gasoline.
Brazil's making ethanol on a huge basis from sugar cane. They're talking about Brazil running on rum and America running on moonshine. But what percentage of America's energy needs, even just gasoline needs, might conceivably come from ethanol, Alexei?
Well, that's a tough question. You know, the problem you run into right there is in those kinds of calculations is the amount of corn that we have, you know, currently available. Because we've chosen to make ethanol at the present from corn as opposed to sugar, which is actually 30% cheaper if you do it the Brazilian way.
But we grow corn in this country.
We grow corn in this country. That's true. But there's other, you know, that's true. But there were a lot of sort of farm state politics that resulted in
yep.
the corn being used for ethanol. So right now, I mean, the estimates are that if you were to actually try to grow, you know, to grow all the soybean and corn production, well, all the corn, let's stick with ethanol, that you wanted to into fuel, you'd only replace about 12% of the gasoline demand in the United States. So that's if you use all the corn that we have, you know, on current acreage.
Every bit, and never mind corn dogs and what the cattle and hogs and chickens and everything else eats. The Energy Department put out a roadmap for American energy talking about maybe something like 30%
right.
that requirement coming from ethanol. 60 billion gallons required to do that. Where are we now?
Well, right now we're at 4.5 billion gallons of ethanol production right now. And, you know, to get to that place where you're talking about the 30 billion gallons would require, you know, a huge increase, an enormous increase that really most people don't see as that plausible. But, you know, it would require a new technology in the cellulosic ethanol arena, which is really the future many people see in the sort of in biofuels in the United States, if you're going to do it, is to use things like switchgrass and wheat straw and other sorts of agricultural products that are not as energy intensive, frankly, to produce. Because corn is the most energy intensive and water intensive, perhaps, crop produced in America. In other words, it's the most expensive
mm-hmm.
crop produced in America, and it also receives the highest subsidies from the U.S. government.
So the next phase, cellulosic ethanol, that's where you basically pour almost any kind of biomass in here, even wood chips or organic garbage, and somehow turn that into fuel.
That's the thinking, but the problem is there's a big if with that. I mean, that technology is not really here. There's one demonstration plant in Canada by a company called Iogen that is currently promoting cellulosic ethanol.
And Goldman Sachs investing big in that, so some investment bankers think there's something going on there.
That's true, and, you know, Goldman Sachs is a smart outfit, but, you know, they have to get it going, and there are a number of sort of things they got to deal with. They got to deal with the transportation issues of how to move around a bunch of, you know, switchgrass and things like that. There is no infrastructure for that. Things that, frankly, may take more energy. You know, and Goldman Sachs is not so interested in, you know, to their credit, in necessarily in long-term sustainable development, although they're a better company than many than that bank, but in that regard. But they're interested in profit. And, I mean, that's certainly what people are looking at, is short to medium-term investments here, where they turn over their money on these plants. Frankly, right now, you can make your money back on an ethanol plant in less than 2 years.
So there's the boom factor. You mentioned subsidies. A lot of excitement. Subsidies play a part. I mean, even Archer's Daniel Midland, the huge grain processing company based there in Illinois, their new chief executive, a former Chevron oil executive. So they're looking hard at this. What's the subsidy factor here, Alexei? How's it played in? What has Congress done?
Well, what Congress has done, there's been a subsidy in place for many years. It's fluctuated a bit from 60 cents a gallon to now the current 51 cent a gallon subsidy, which means, and that subsidy goes to the refiners of the ethanol, which doesn't necessarily mean it's the farmers that make the corn, although many farmers are trying to get involved in co-ops that are producing ethanol, that are, you know, putting together ethanol plants themselves, so they're benefiting if they have that kind of capital. But it's 51 cents a gallon, and that's on top of the already very, very healthy margins right now that we're experiencing. So it's incredibly profitable at the moment, and it would take, I think we calculated in one of our stores, it would take, you know, an oil price of only like $39 without the subsidy for ethanol to be break even, in other words. And, of course, right now we're at, well, about $80.
So there's plenty of margin in there. Alexei Baranova in Chicago, please stand by, if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation from Ames, Iowa, Professor John Mironowski. He's professor of economics at Iowa State University, director of the Institute of Science and Society at Iowa State. Professor Mironowski, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We feel the excitement just rolling out of the Midwest on this ethanol boom. As an economist, how do you look at it? Is this a big sort of Saudi future for Midwestern corn farmers?
I think it's an important future for Midwestern corn farmers, Iowa being the largest corn and soybean producing state and the largest ethanol producer right now. What I see happening is that we've got a very rapidly growing industry and a very rapidly evolving industry. I think corn-based ethanol is the beginning of the wave. I anticipate seeing in the next decade a lot more commercialization of biomass feedstocks in the process here.
Biomass feedstocks, can you define what do you mean?
Okay, what I'm talking about is everything from corn stover and stocks to...
So instead of just the kernels off the cob, the whole stalk, everything, use the whole...
The whole stalk. Not that we would want to harvest the whole stalk for environmental reasons and soil loss and things of that nature, but if we did, we could more than double the output of ethanol per acre, which is around 500 gallons based on the corn grain alone in Iowa. We would probably have close to 1,150 gallons of ethanol an acre if we did harvest all the corn stover biomass that came off that in addition to the corn.
So do you think Iowa farmers and towns will be richer in an ethanol era than they've been in a corn feed era?
They definitely will be better off in the process. And also one other point I'd like to make is that the way a lot of the government subsidies work is it's when there are very low corn prices that the government subsidies kick in, or the loan deficiency payments. And what's going to happen is as the price of corn as a feedstock rises, we're going to see the going away of those subsidies simply because the demand for corn is going to drive the price up in the marketplace. And we can even see that coming on the horizon in terms of what's happening to futures prices in the next harvest season.
At the Chicago Board of Trade, they're talking about demand shock in corn markets. Big prices coming. Nothing comes for free, Professor. So what happens if, I mean, as Alexei says, on the other side of corn, there's a lot more biomass waiting if the technology comes through to be converted into energy. But if corn and maybe soybeans become huge sources through ethanol and biodiesel of new energy, What's the cost of that? What, for example, happens to grocery prices? What does livestock eat if everything goes into the ethanol plant?
This is one that's been, I think, distorted in a lot of reports I've read on the impacts here. I think particularly in the food area and grocery prices, it's going to have relatively modest impacts. If you look at a box of cornflakes, you know, it's just a few cents going into a box of cornflakes that may cost $3-4 in the grocery store. Meat probably will rise in price somewhat, but ethanol or corn as a feed is going to be substituted in many cases for the DDGs or the distillers, dried grains and solubles that are coming out of the ethanol production process. That works as a very good feed for dairy and beef cattle. And so in that area, we've got a relatively inexpensive substitute coming out for feeding corn as a grain. In the case of animals like hogs and chickens, we've got new processes that are probably will be commercialized in the next year or so that will actually produce a high protein feed for them. So it's not going to be taking away nearly the or creating the competition in the feed markets that we anticipate right. I mean, that a lot of people are anticipating right now.
Alexi Barrionuevo, you and your crew have done some reporting with others who fear differently. You talked with, I mean, everybody's got an interest in here. It starts to get interesting. Archer Daniels Midland, big in ethanol, they're all for it with their Chevron CEO now. You talked to Warren Staley, chief executive at Cargill up in Minnesota. They're more food grain processing oriented, and he's singing a different tune, saying we may have high food prices or even food shortages. How's that look to you, that claim?
Yeah, I think that's true, and I don't necessarily agree with the professor there. I mean, he talks about the DDGs and how they can be a substitute for livestock.
And what are those again, DDGs?
Dry distiller grains. That's sort of the extra stuff that comes off of you know, the process when you're making the ethanol.
It's okay.
Sort of a byproduct.
A byproduct as food,
right.
Yeah.
Right, and you know, there is some of that that can be used in livestock, poultry, and hogs, but actually in poultry particularly, it's a very low percentage that the poultry can handle, like maybe 10% is what agricultural nutritionists tell me. So it's not really a perfect substitute at all, and there is concern in the livestock industry for sure about what, you know, impact this is all going to have on their industry. I mean, corn, more than half of the corn in the United States goes to feeding livestock, so it's not really, you know, as used for human food production. But at the same time, as Warren Staley notes and other, you know, economists, there is the concern that, you know, this food for fuel sort of competition is going to heat up. You're even seeing, you know, some evidence in just recent weeks of concerns, you know, over food prices that energy prices have pushed up and concerns about higher sort of prices that are being fueled by the ethanol boom. I was talking to the Kellogg Company
yeah.
This morning, and they were noting that, of course, they're increasing cereal prices for the first time in 2 years, and that's related to energy and sort of the sort of aura of ethanol out there and what it's doing in terms of straining potential supply. So, you know, going forward, there is a real concern, and there's a concern about available, you know, cropland to increase corn production if we stick with corn, if these other feedstocks don't, you know, become realistic economically and technologically.
Right. We'll look at those issues as well, but I want to begin to bring our listeners in. A lot want to join this conversation. First, from Hartford, Connecticut, Myron's on the line. Hi, Myron. You're on the air.
Morning, Tom. Appreciate this program a great deal. I have two thoughts. One is that I think that we may, in the short haul, certainly have to, and I'd like your guest's input on this.
Yeah.
Certainly like to balance the economic aspect of this relative to profit with the necessity for this nation's future to lessen our dependency on Mideastern oil.
You're saying that just can't go on, so take that as a starting point.
Yes. The second is that I believe that we really need to get serious about this in terms of the government response and the political response, similar to our Manhattan Project, where we need to free up some of that $11 million per hour we're spending on this catastrophic war effort with research and development monies.
So you're ready to be gung-ho here, Myron, and even go to a Manhattan Project, crank it up a little higher. Let us look at that. And I have to admit, full disclosure, I grew up on a corn farm. It's still in the family. If corn farmers become Saudi princes, well, you know, there's a couple pennies in my pocket as well. John Maranowski, Myron in Hartford, Connecticut, says, let's put the pedal to the metal on this. We've got to do this. It's a matter of necessity, not just profit and loss. Is that dynamic in play in Iowa as people talk about it, think about it? And do you feel like we're doing everything we can to go down the biomass road quickly?
No, I think we need to be moving even more rapidly. And as I mentioned, you know, this is a very rapidly evolving industry. I anticipate we're going to see much more coming online in terms of biomass feedstocks as we go into the next decade. The only thing is that when corn is cheap, corn is by far the most efficient or effective feedstock that we've got for making ethanol. When corn prices rise, that's going to send signals into the marketplace for the development of biomass technologies that are going to do this effectively. We've had a long history in this country of a cheap energy policy. All of us hate to pay the prices at the pump right now when we fill up. But the point is that that cheap energy policy has kept these biorenewable products out of the marketplace.
Because it just wasn't, we weren't paying enough for gasoline to make these economical.
We weren't paying enough for gasoline, and I mean, to bring these types of technologies into the marketplace. What really has driven this ethanol boom is $70 a barrel crude oil. And if you look at that, at least at about 2009, we anticipate it's going to stay in the $65, $70 range. That's what's really driving this whole wave, because ethanol becomes a substitute, a fuel extender, if you will, and reduces our reliance on foreign oil.
And with the kind of instability we see in that region right now, I'm sure that perspective just grows. Alexa, we've just got you for another minute. How do you see this on balance when you talk right across the industry and beyond? Is this the future? Is this a boondoggle bubble waiting to burst?
Well, I mean, I think the professor makes some good points there. That the drivers that will trigger things are what everyone would hope for. That would increase the money and research into new technologies. That's what has to happen. But what really is lacking in this whole ethanol debate, people say consistently, is anybody that's sort of looking at this in a holistic way, looking across all the different factors and constituent groups and trying to sort of create policy. You don't have that. You don't have anyone that's looking, it seems, at sustainable development at the same time they're looking at, how do we deal with, replacing Middle East oil. There's nobody that's looking at the whole picture.
Alexi, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Pete's calling from Ogdensburg, New York. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Greetings from America's North Coast.
Okay, good to have you, Pete. What do you see?
Well, what I see here is a little too much euphoria and not quite enough sobriety. My agreement comes with one of your panelists that said that we're not taking the broader view here, and that comes from the fact that corn is a huge nitrogen consumer, and to make the
nitrates of fertilizers into corn
that fertilize requires a lot of hydrocarbons. So you've got to heat and pressurize these molecules in order to get them to release and to join. And I'm beginning to wonder if we're not subsidizing the oil companies in yet another way by producing the fertilizer that's going to take to make all the corn.
So a backdoor boon in hydrocarbons, even as we talk about ethanol.
That's correct.
With everything that means. You know, that of course, is the old rap on ethanol, that it takes more energy to make it than it provides once it's made.
Amen, Brother Tom. Well said. Now the sobriety is entering into the conversation.
Okay, well, we'll put the moonshine aside just for a second and do a double check on that. Pete, thanks for your call. To answer that, I want to turn to New York and Nathaniel Green, Senior Energy Policy Analyst at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Nathaniel Green, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
How about this question? The old charge, ethanol takes more energy to make than it ends up delivering. True or false?
Well, false, but probably the wrong question to really be asking.
Now, why? Why?
Yeah. As the caller put it, and this is, I think, a very common misconception, that we actually use a lot of oil to make ethanol. And the reality is actually that we use almost very, very little oil to make ethanol, both in the growing, the making the fertilizers, a little bit of diesel to transport stuff around and harvest stuff. the ethanol facilities themselves use almost no diesel.
You say no fuel, but I've seen numbers that sort of, well, all kinds of numbers, but some that say more, you know, units of energy go into this production with the cost of building the tractor and creating the fertilizer and driving it through the fields than the ethanol produces. And you say no? Is that clear? Well, is that widely consensus?
Let me be specific. I'm actually talking about no oil. We actually use a fair amount of natural gas and coal. So there's this general question out there about oil displacement and are we going to be able to get off of our oil addiction.
So the oil is one piece of it, but our caller was asking about hydrocarbons and, of course, and their greenhouse effect more broadly, I assume.
Exactly.
He's looking at.
Yeah. So I think the two really important questions are what can ethanol do for our addiction to oil, and what can ethanol do for our global warming pollution problems and the climate change crisis that we're facing.
You're saying it will help on the addiction to oil but won't solve the climate change problem?
It's not going to solve the climate change problem. The numbers have definitely changed dramatically over the history of the ethanol industry. And today, ethanol from corn provides a modest reduction in greenhouse gases. But as you've been talking about the whole food versus fuel challenge and the dynamics of the agricultural market that will drive up the price of corn and therefore put a natural limit on the amount of ethanol we can produce from corn. And when you combine that natural limit, which even if you talk to the corn growers and their sort of wildest dream is maybe about 20 billion gallons by 2020, when you look at that amount,
4 or 5 times what they're producing now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but recall that we use about 140 billion gallons of gasoline, and by 2020 that'll be closer to 200 billion gallons. So 20 billion gallons, huge growth in this industry, but is it big enough to save us from our climate change crisis? No. And that's why this evolution to the next generation of technology, which can not only provide greater benefits from a greenhouse gas perspective per gallon, but also unlock the potential to produce a lot more gallons, is so important. The other point I would make is, and I think going back to the caller's question and the sort of need to look at the big picture here, is in all this discussion and enthusiasm about biofuels, and I think it's easy to lose the long-term perspective here and the scale of the challenge that we face of our oil addiction and more broadly our addiction to fossil fuels. Biofuels can be a tremendous part of the solution, but they are only a part of the solution. And we really need to keep our eye on the broader package here, which has to include using fossil fuels more efficiently and using biofuels more efficiently. If we put good ethanol into a gas-guzzling SUV, we're just wasting that ethanol and wasting the land that we use to grow the crops that were used to make the ethanol.
So we've got to be careful not to get into a shell game here where you're just moving around the cost of this in the excitement over new industries. On the other hand, as you say, some kind of movement's necessary here. Let me get a call from Eleanor. She's calling, Eleanor, I think, from the side of Highway 80 in Iowa. Is that right?
That's right, right in the middle of corn country.
Well, what's your question, Eleanor, or comment?
Well, I'm traveling around Iowa this week, and I've met a lot of folks who are involved in the corn business. And one of the issues that they've brought up to me, and it's something that I heard, I believe, a month or two ago, also in the New York Times, is that when the ethanol boom started a few years back, most of the processing facilities were owned by these farmer cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
And now I guess about 80% of the new production facilities are owned by either agribusinesses like ADM, which you mentioned, or even companies out of the country. And they're the ones who are capturing that value-added profit, and they're the ones who are getting the government subsidies that are going to processors and distributors.
So who's going to profit from this?
Right. And so my question is really, is this even a short-term economic boom for rural communities and corn farmers, or are we just sort of shifting our dependence on big oil over to dependence on big agriculture?
Let us look at that. John Marinowski, you ought to be well-placed to respond. I guess Archer Daniels Midland, number one ethanol producer now, almost a quarter of the market just from that huge agribusiness corporation. You hear Eleanor's question. How do you respond?
I would respond to Eleanor's question in this way. The industry capacity in Iowa right now is probably providing close to 6,000 jobs. in rural communities around Iowa. They're relatively good paying jobs, and we are a state that's not growing very rapidly, and we need employment opportunities. I think there's going to be outside capital moving into this industry, and that's happening more rapidly as this industry matures. But I would be willing to estimate that over half the plants in Iowa are still being built by smaller groups of local residents, not necessarily in cooperatives. They may be limited liability corporations, and there's still a lot of that will reside in the local community. If this industry is going to grow, there's going to be outside capital moving in, and I don't see that as the the bad side of this whole picture. I think that's what the industry requires. But there's another piece of this that I think is very important. And this industry is evolving more into what I would call a bio-based products industry.
Meaning?
High-valued products like fibers that go into carpets that DuPont's producing, plastics that are commercially biodegradable that NatureWorks is producing out in Nebraska.
So instead of plastic coming from an oil well, coming from a cornfield, and all of agriculture moving into a much sort of broader supply chain.
A much broader supply chain. And the other point I would like to make is that it's not an industry that is going to solve the energy crisis by itself. I mean, I don't care if it's ethanol based on corn grain or on biomass. We've got to develop all the different alternatives in the process if we're going to have an impact on the energy markets. I mean, wind is expanding rapidly in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
A number of other types of energy sources, various gasification processes. I mean, BP now has announced they're going to produce butanol and do a lot of research to bring on butanol as a fuel source.
Is butanol a biomass-sourced fuel
yes.
as well?
Yes, definitely a biomass source. And so there are all kinds of syngas processes. And I think there's a goal, I mean, a group called 25 by 25 that's pushing very hard on having 25% of energy coming from, all energy, coming from biorenewable sources by 2025. And we've got a tremendous amount of research going on here at Iowa State on developing alternative bio-based products in addition to improving a lot of the processes that may produce biomass fuels in the future.
So maybe you will be the new Saudi Arabia there.
We may be the new Saudi Arabia, but we're not going to replace 100% of that oil that we're, even the oil we're importing in this process. What's going to do that is going to be the price of petroleum.
Mm.
And if the price of petroleum stays high, we'll see a lot more biorenewable ways coming into the system to replace it.
Of course, listeners like Eleanor are going to be keeping a close eye on where all the benefit goes. Let's take
right.
a call from Washington, D.C. Todd's on the line. Hi, Todd. You're on the air.
Hi. I really have a comment just to speak, not so much to the economics of ethanol, but just to the technology behind it or to the quality of it.
What do you know about it, Todd?
I'm involved in the auto motorsport community, the auto racing community. I'm a former
race car driver
myself. Yes.
Okay,
I'm
great.
Involved in motorsport. And I just wanted to just quickly comment on the quality of ethanol.
Would you race on ethanol? It doesn't have, as I understand it, ethanol doesn't have the same oomph as gasoline. So you have to sort of fill up a little more often.
Well, it in the higher line forms of American racing, ethanol and methanol blend is used. And by next year, they're going to be even increasing the percentage of ethanol in the race fuels.
Really?
And actually, ethanol is a better quality fuel than fuel that's refined from crude oil.
Now, I presume that's not for environmental reasons on the racetrack, Todd, that they can get more speed out of an ethanol-methanol mix?
Yeah, well, methanol is a more volatile, fuel. It's got a much higher octane rating, and it is cleaner burning, and it's a hotter fuel. It's a little bit more dangerous in some respects, but it evaporates quicker too. So in some respects, it's not as oily or as greasy. So it takes less time for, you know, to extinguish an ethanol or methanol fire. But it's kind of beside the point. The point is, it's just a better fuel. It's on all accounts.
So here's the two thumbs up from a race car driver. Todd, thanks for your call. Nathaniel Green, how about it? How about the experience of driving on ethanol? First of all, just access to it. I mean, they're talking about this new corridor where you can fill up on high test ethanol fuels all the way from Chicago to Kansas City. But in lots of parts of the country, I don't know if people can get it. And if and when they do, what's it feel like driving on ethanol rather than gasoline if you're not on the racetrack with a methanol mix?
Right. Well, the fact of the matter is most of us around the country have probably driven on a blend of ethanol and may well not have ever known it. Ethanol is a very commonly used additive for gasoline to raise the octane. The issue, the part of the reason that race car drivers like it so much is that you can get a little bit more oomph out of it. So especially in the Northeast and in California, we drive on something called E10 most of the time, which is a blend of 10% ethanol and 90% gasoline.
But when you get up to E85, 85% ethanol, what's that like?
Well, see, I think that's the real key, and that's got to be our goal. If we're really talking about getting off of gasoline, moving away from it, we got to stop using ethanol as an additive and start using it as an alternative. So as I was saying, most of us, we might have used ethanol. We've never had a choice. When we go to the pump, we can choose between gas and gas and gas. We need to get to a point where we can choose between gas and an alternative like E85. Driving on E85 in a modern vehicle there are these vehicles that the auto manufacturers are producing now called flex fuel vehicles that can run on regular gasoline or E85 or any blend in between. And from a driver's perspective, it's indistinguishable, except for the point that you raised, which is there isn't as much energy in a gallon of E85 as there is in a gallon of gasoline. So you're going to go back to the pump a little bit more often.
Mm. Let me, if I may, get one more call here, Nathaniel. Andy is calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up on a small farm in Iowa, and I've been working for many years in agricultural conservation, and I want to get back to that issue if we could.
Yes, please.
Really briefly.
The environmental piece.
Yeah, you've touched on the climate change, but I'm concerned about a different aspect of it, and that is if the price of corn does go up, even a little bit, we'll probably see more acreage put into corn, which means probably more steeper land, which we've been working for many years to get out of production.
Right.
To the soil loss problems. And we'll also, with more acreage, see a great deal more nitrogen fertilizer used, which then means more pollution along with the soil in our streams, but also higher costs for purification water plants, and probably an increase in the problem of hypoxia in the Gulf,
potentially
very significant.
Mm-hmm. So keep an eye on the side effects. John Marinowski, how about it? Are we going to see, they used to say fence row to fence row corn, but now they don't even have fences. I mean, are you going to take all the fallow land out of production and... Yeah, we're going to see corn just wall-to-wall in the Midwest. What about the environmental impact of that?
No, I don't think we'll see corn wall-to-wall or road-to-road in the Midwest in the future. I think what's going to happen is that there may be some crowding out of soybeans, but they're an erosive crop as well. Going on to more highly erodible land, such as expiring CRP contracts, is possible for a small amount, but I don't think anybody anticipates that's going to be very large.
This is the land that the government's essentially paid to keep out of production. You don't think it's going to come in as demand grows here?
Depending on what the government does on renewing CRP contracts. If they don't renew CRP contracts, some of that will come back into production. It's probably less than 500,000 acres from estimates I've seen for a state like Iowa. But I do think that, you know, also I think with nitrogen fertilizer, as long as natural gas prices stay higher, return to their higher levels that they're predicted to, again, I think we'll use less nitrogen fertilizer, possibly no more than we are today, even if we expand corn acreage. A lot of this is driven by what happens in natural gas and petroleum markets.
A big chessboard and a big wave coming. It looks green or yellow, looks like corn, and maybe more than that. John Marinowski, professor of economics at Iowa State University, thanks very much for your insights in this hour. Thanks for joining us from Ames.
Thank you, Tom.
And Nathaniel Green at the Natural Resources Defense Council in New York. Nathaniel, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.